Welcome to .NET Rambles, a weekly podcast where Andy and Rowan discuss all things .NET related. Rowan, hello. It's been a long time.
Oh my God, it's been way too long, Andy. What have we been doing for a year?
I've no idea. I don't know what's happened. Just everything. Life really, isn't it? I think we used to say this at the beginning of every, you know, it's like weeks go by, months go by, 6 months, a year, it's crazy. But yeah, it's been a busy one for me because obviously changing contracts, moving around, doing new stuff and yeah, all sorts really. But
yeah, like, yeah. I mean, life's gotten in the way. But like you say, previously we were working together, weren't we? And then we've sort of gone off and done different contracts. And thankfully now we've come together again and we're working at on the same contract really, aren't we?
Back on a project together, which has been great. So yeah, absolutely. And it makes this sort of thing a lot easier, doesn't it? Because you can sort of, you end work and you can carry on a bit. So yeah, it does make it a bit easier to do it. But yeah, it just gets difficult, doesn't it? It's finding the right day, finding the right time, family life, busy. Yeah. So yeah, but there you go. So anyway,
I tell you what, I've missed our random fact of the week. What have we got this time?
Very good. Well, this one sort of ties in with what we're going to talk about today. So it's 22. I'm not going to go through all 22, by the way. It's 22 fun facts about the number 8, because obviously .NET 8 is coming.
Nice. And,
so this is. I've pulled a few little ones out just about it. So I'll go through these quick. So the digit 8 is formed by two circles or loops, making it visually symmetrical and pleasing to the eye.
Very nice. That it is. Yeah.
It is indeed.
Yeah. Good. So, I like it.
The number 8 is considered lucky in many cultures as well. So Chinese and Japanese cultures consider it a lucky number.
Okay.
So, there you go. 8's the highest digit in the octal numeral system, making it a powerful and significant. I don't know how it's a powerful and significant number, but it is in the octal system, which obviously is sort of a codey thing.
So, funny that. Yeah. Excellent.
In mathematics, the number 8 is a perfect cube, as it can be expressed as 2 raised to the power of 3.
To the power of 3.
I'll take the word for it. I'm not very good at math. So I'll, yeah.
2 sure times 2 true. Times...
2? 2 times 2. Yeah, 2 times 2, 4 times 2, 8. If that's how that works.
Probably there we go.
Good.
Very nice.
In music, which this is more your thing, isn't it? An octave is a musical interval.
Otherwise known as an octave. Yeah.
An octave, yeah.
Octave, yeah.
Octave, octave.
8 notes.
8 notes, yeah. Spanning 8 notes. And the last one I found very interesting, I didn't realize this, the atomic number of oxygen, which obviously is a crucial element for sustaining life. We find it quite useful. Some people waste a lot of oxygen that I've worked with, but, you know, that's another story.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's number 8. So atomic number of oxygen is 8.
Beautiful. Okay. Very nice. Well, I've got one that trumps all of those.
Uh-huh.
And that is that my wife's favorite number is the number 8.
There you go. That's the most important thing, isn't it?
Yeah, so, absolutely. So she's going to love .NET 8 when it comes out. And that segues
for her. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That segues beautifully into what we're actually going to be covering off today, which is...
We are looking at what's new in .NET 8.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
what's coming, what we've been sort of reading about. There's so much information out there. It's huge. There's loads of pages on Microsoft's site. There's loads of people blogging about it, loads of YouTube videos. It's huge. And obviously they're about to launch it. I think, we're recording this in November time, aren't we? And it's going to be launched very soon in the next couple of weeks. So I think by the time this goes out, it will be available. So it'd be interesting to know what people think of it and if they started using it, if people get to use it, of course, because a lot of companies don't get to use it because it's too new or it's not supported or whatever in your environment. I think we're looking at bringing it into some of ours, aren't we? Because hopefully some of the cloud platforms are going to support this as the long-term version. So
it's looking like it's the LTS, the long-term support version, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So a lot of the cloud providers will jump straight on and offer it. And certainly where we are, we're gonna jump on it as soon as it's available.
Yeah, hopefully the benefits will be easily seeable because performance improvements and lots of new features. So
excellent. Well, let's get into it. I mean, .NET 8 covers a massive area of stuff. And what we've done in the past when we sort of go through new versions is we tend to break the broader .NET ecosystem down into ASP.NET, which is an area that web-based people are obviously very interested in. So we might do that today. So we'll sort of look at the ASP.NET 8 features. We've also got C# 12 coming out as part of the .NET 8 release. And then we've got the sort of the foundational .NET 8 updates. So let's sort of run through them in those categories.
Sounds good.
Yeah, nice. So, I mean, let's start with ASP.NET 8, or otherwise known as ASP.NET Core 8, and have a look at some of the features and new things, new shiny stuff that's coming out. What have we got to begin with?
Yeah, so going from the top. So again, we pulled all these off some of the various pages, and we just put them into, it's a sort of random order we just pulled together. But yeah, the first thing we looked at is root tooling. Root syntax highlighting and root analyzers, which is really nice. For a long time, it's difficult to know sort of what roots you've got on the various things, but now it highlights the various elements in your root so that you can see what they are. So you've basically got, you know, the same highlighting as you would get for keywords and various other things. So
very nice,
really nice. Yeah, it brings it out a lot more, so you can see it. And we've got an example there, so that'll be on our webpage for this. But yeah, it does look really good.
Excellent. So yeah, just delving into that really quickly. So if you're expressing a root, where you might have a /books/book ID, mm-hmm. So up until this point, that the tooling, i.e. Visual Studio or Visual Studio Code, or you know, choose your IDE of choice, yeah. Wouldn't necessarily know which part of that root is a parameter and what the data type of those parameters is. Yeah. Whereas I think now the tooling will pick up the parameters and the data types, and controller names if you've got default controllers and actions and that sort of stuff. So yeah, very useful.
Absolutely.
Very
cool. That's it. Yeah, it's very nice. Very nice. So. Yep. So there's things like root constraint performance improvements.
Brilliant.
And this is going to be something we'll probably mention quite a few times as we go through this. Performance improvements is just, they focus so much on that. So there's loads in there. So
yeah.
And then we've got these new analyzers.
Yeah.
So API development, new analyzers. So lots of things coming in. So basically giving you output to show you what's going wrong, what you can improve on. So
marvelous.
Things like not returning a value from a request delegate or suggesting various things. I'm just looking through one of these, it might be a useful one. A root conflict detected between root handlers.
I've just seen that one as well. Yeah, that looks good, doesn't it? Yeah.
0022. So if you get one of those, that's what that's all about.
And brilliant. Or things like multiple from body attributes in in your actions, that sort of thing. So there's a whole host of extra analyzers that have been added. That's
very
cool.
Handy. Yeah. So then we're on to things like dispatch exceptions to Blazor's synchronization context. We decided not to go into these in depth because we'd need about 24 hours. It's crazy, but yeah. So we're going to rattle through these. So there's lots and lots of things in Blazor. We've got another bit coming up on that in a minute. So we'll go through more Blazor stuff. But hot reload support for instance fields, properties, and events. .NET on WebAssembly. So obviously WebAssembly is getting bigger and bigger. More people are starting to look into it.
Brilliant.
Symbol servers when debugging .NET on WebAssembly. Blazor WebAssembly debugging in Firefox.
Very nice.
Yeah. Specify the initial URL for Blazor WebView to load. And new options to keep the SPAR development server running. So,
excellent. Excellent. As you say, I think there's been a whole host of Blazor sort of updates and WebAssembly sort of improvements. So we can delve into the Blazor specific stuff a little bit further on, can't we?
Yeah, absolutely.
But you know, just back on the subject of tooling, I remember it was probably 12 months ago. I remember seeing James Newton King tweet about some stuff that he was working on in .NET 8. And that was around tooling in Visual Studio, Visual Studio Code. Again, choose your IDE of choice. That's really around what you see when you're debugging stuff in the HTTP context. So up until .NET 8, in .NET 7, if you look at a HTTP context in Visual Studio, for example, you don't get a great deal of information about what's actually contained in there. So, the items in the context, the request, the response, a session, a lot of that information was sort of buried away or came back as just a default two-string implementation on each of those properties. Whereas in .NET 8, I think what they've actually done is gone through and basically put in two-string implementations for all of the different property data types on a HTTP context. So, your connection, your endpoint, your features, your items, your request, your response, your session, if you've got one, the user, all of that stuff will now be visible through your IDE, which is quite nice.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing to visualize, to be honest. When I first sort of heard about this and we started talking about it, it wasn't until I actually saw these screenshots you've done where you can actually then see it and go, yeah, actually, do you know what? In .NET 7, the only thing really visible is trace identifier. Yeah. Everything else is hidden behind some sort of object and a tree. So you've got to dig into it. So even stupid things like knowing what the response code is, you've got to dig into it and actually click to go and get that. You can't see it straight away. So it's one of those funny things where you don't realize you're missing it until they give you this and you go, oh, that's genius. That's brilliant.
Yes. Yeah.
This is going to make life a lot easier just to be able to see these things straight away.
Absolutely. Just, you know, all visible under one, you know, under one view, you know, great. So a lot of the stuff in the HTTP context, even things like the application sort of lifecycle lifetimes and loggers and services that are available again have had this sort of treatment. So
Very nice, really good
tooling improvements. Yeah. Cool. What have we got next?
Yeah, they're moving on from that to something again that you, once it's mentioned, you realize it's quite important, but securing Swagger endpoints. So of course we use Swagger all the time when we're building APIs. Yeah. You normally shove Swagger in there because it's a really nice UI and it obviously generates some extra stuff for you that you can use the UI or you can use the Swagger files to then generate clients and do all sorts. So it's really, really valuable. But you know, one of the big things is it's normally wrapped up in a, if you're in dev mode, show it. Otherwise, don't expose it because it's, you know, it can contain stuff you don't want people to see.
You don't necessarily want a sort of a gateway into your API in production, do you? That someone could stumble across and start executing endpoints.
Yeah, yeah. It shows, you know, obviously public API is not such a big issue, I would have thought. But for, you know, for other ones, it does show absolutely everything that you've got in there. So it's quite difficult to do anything about it. But they've introduced this new extension point. So basically within your program CS or your startup CS, you basically now just do app.mapswagger.requireauthorization.
Very cool.
And then that's then going to only allow people into it that are authorized. So yeah, you know, there's obviously more to it, to how you authorize people and how you get things in there. But it's nice you've now got that feature. You haven't got to find a way around it and actually protect certain pages and, you know, and that. So yeah, it's
very nice.
Very handy.
Lovely. Yeah. Excellent. All right, let's move on. So, you know, we mentioned some of the Blazor updates already, but there's a whole host of them. There's, you know, we're looking at a massive bullet point list of loads of them. So let's rattle through them and just cover them off quickly.
Yeah, what absolutely. Have we got? Yeah, so I think with Blazor, they're really pushing Blazor. They're sort of, I think it's their new thing, isn't it? And they really want people using it. So they've got so much focus on it. You've got new Blazor web app templates.
Yeah.
You can persist component state in a Blazor web app now. So making it easier to sort of, you know, keep data there and reuse it. Form handling and model binding has been improved. Yeah. Enhanced navigation and form handling. Streaming rendering.
Brilliant. An
interesting one. Injecting keyed services into components, which is a very interesting point. And it's something else we're going to sort of come to in a bit. We've got a section on this because it's a really nice feature that they've introduced.
Keyed services, finally. Yeah, marvelous. We'll get to that. Get to that later. Yeah.
Accessing the HTTP context as a cascading parameter. And these things are probably going to make more sense to other people that have been working on Blazor, but these are the things people have been after and trying to get to. So rendering Razor components outside of ASP.NET Core. So it's
very
interesting
nice.
Feature. Yeah.
Yeah.
Section support, error page support, a thing called a quick grid, which was really nice. When I came across it, again, it's one of those things you took for granted in the old days, back when you had like web forms and stuff like that. You got a grid for free, you know. It came with a grid, and you could use it. And to be honest, most websites use a grid or a table of some sort to display things. So this is really nice. They've now got a grid that you can just drop in and use it to display everything. So
very nice,
very handy. Root to named elements, root level cascading values, virtualize empty context. Close circuits when there are no remaining interactive server components. So again, I think these are little performance things where you're not exhausting things on your server if people aren't using them. If your clients have gone, you're reusing stuff and actually closing it down.
Nice.
Monitoring SignalR circuit activity.
Excellent. And again, I think there's a handful of sort of SignalR support, extra support that's gone in with Blazor, which is quite nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you put the two of those technologies together, WebAssembly and SignalR, and you know, you've got yourself a nice nice little setup there.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I haven't done stuff with SignalR for a long time, but you know, when you go and use it, you realize how good it is. And you know, you've got really nice libraries there. It integrates really nicely. Obviously, you get your typed JS support for it. And that plugs in nicely into your hubs. And it just all works really well. And you sort of, again, take it for granted. But, you know, the fact that this sort of is a backbone of Blazor when you're doing communication between the server and the client.
Yes.
There are, I've read quite a lot of people, you know, it's frustrations when you lose connection. So I think they're putting a lot more in there to make this reconnect and make it better. So
yeah, nice. But lovely.
Then we're on to faster runtime performance with the Jitterpreter. I don't know if there's a typo or if we copied that correctly, but yeah, the Jitterpreter. Oh, yeah, yeah. It's one of them anyway.
It's an interpreter
with a jitter on it. So,
and that's faster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Then Blazor WebAssembly debugging improvements, making things easier to debug. Support for dialogue cancel and close events. So, I think this was the default HTML dialogue. That's now got support for the cancel and close events being raised when you use that.
Marvelous.
And they've got Blazor Identity UI, which again, I haven't used Blazor for a while now. I've not been sort of keeping up to date with what they've added to it, but obviously you've now got the ability to chuck in a identity UI in a similar way, I think, to what you were doing with the various MVC and Razor pages. You could just bring in their identity controls and use it to plug in identity, which is great. So
now Blazor is Blazor's aligning.
I mean, they're just a few of the new features and improvements. There's so much, and throughout a lot of this, we're trying to put links to the different pages, so it's well worth sort of going through them, finding it, and reading up on it, because there's good examples there. They sort of take you through what they've done. So
yeah, it's really good stuff.
So excellent. What's next?
Let's move on. Well, an area that's been an area of interest that came in I think in .NET 6 is minimal APIs. Was it .NET 6? Perhaps.
I think so.
Perhaps. .NET Core, .NET 6, but you know, .NET 6, it was introduced. .NET 7, there were some improvements. .NET 8, again, they've been pushing forward with minimal APIs. So things like binding to forms with the from form attributes now supported, anti-forgery middleware, service registration with dependency injection, so you can do things like builder.services.add anti-forgery, which is quite nice for minimal APIs. Support for as parameters, so you've got automatic sort of metadata generation for request and response types in your minimal APIs, which is quite nice. So they're pushing forward with minimal APIs, you know, in terms of the functionality. But as well as that, it looks like there's been a fair bit of work gone in to allowing minimal APIs to work for ahead of time compilation. So AOT. And again, there's been a fair bit of work for AOT support in .NET, in ASP.NET 8. It looks like there's been a fair bit of effort to try and get minimal APIs supported in ahead of time compiled apps, which is really great. So just sort of delving into that a little bit, it looks like they've come up with a thing called a request delegate generator, so RDG, which basically takes what used to be generated off the back of your minimal APIs at runtime. So, you know, .NET 7, if you come up with a minimal API solution, those delegates would get mapped at runtime. So if you had a map get method and you've got your delegate code in there, that delegate code would get wired up into the pipeline at runtime.
Okay.
But in order to support minimal APIs through AOT, through ahead of time compilation, that stuff needs to be compiled down at compile time, not at runtime.
Yeah, right, of course, because it needs to be ahead of time. Yeah,
absolutely.
Before you actually put it out there, right?
You know, before the thing runs. So they've introduced a thing called request delegate generator, which basically goes through and takes all those delegates from the map gets and the map posts and turns them into code at compile time, therefore making minimal APIs available through AOT as well, which is quite nice. There is a small point about this request delegate generator saying that you can turn it on for non-AOT projects as well. And then I guess the question is, why would you want to do that? And there's two points really. The first is that if you're trying to get, you know, trying to convert a project that's not ahead of time compiled and you want to move that to AOT, you can turn this thing on just as a test, just to see how ready that project is to move to AOT.
Yeah.
You could also turn this thing on, pardon me, Just to save some time at startup, so to improve your startup time. Right. So you can turn on this request delegate generator, which will take your minimal APIs and basically compile them down at compile time. So it's not dependent upon AOT being enabled. It's a separate sort of feature, but the reason they introduced it was to be able to support AOT. So quite a nice little introduction there. So yeah, minimal APIs has gotten some love and ultimately, you know, you can make them faster.
Yeah, great.
Which is good. Yeah.
Sure. Okay. So moving on to the next bit, I think we had a little bit here, didn't we? Just a sort of a little where we chucked everything that didn't fit anywhere else. So we've got little smaller bits and pieces just to rattle through. So we had things like support for named pipes in Kestrel.
Yeah, absolutely. So named pipes have been around for a long time, haven't they? Yeah, there may be people out there still connecting, to databases through named pipes, for example. So
previously, really popped up a lot.
Mm-hmm. You couldn't do that if you were hosting on Kestrel, but now you can, which is great. Cool. Yeah.
And yeah, more people using Kestrel to host because obviously, it sits there inside Docker and stuff, and you proxy it, and it's pretty good. So, HTTP3 support enabled by default, which is good.
Very cool.
Moving towards that.
Yeah.
Then HTTP2 over TLS support on macOS, which I'm guessing is something people have been after for a while.
Yeah. Very nice. Signal then, sort of hub connection. Builder improvements, so you can specify server timeout and keep alive time in the hub connection builder, which I think used to be a bit more verbose in the previous version. So some improvements there.
Yeah.
HTTP and HTTPS ports config support. So, much easier to specify your HTTP or SSL or TLS ports. Mm-hmm. And warnings when the specified HTTP protocols won't be used. So smaller bits and pieces. Yeah. And again, this isn't a comprehensive list. It's just a few that we picked out.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, moving on. So we're looking at what's new in C# 12 now, which is obviously probably quite interesting to a lot of developers because it's what we live in, really. It's these are all the things that everybody's going to get. So if you're using C#, there's lots of nice new things coming. So what have we got?
Good stuff. So to begin with, we've got primary constructors that are now available on structs and classes. So not just record types.
Right.
So you can add parameters to a struct or a class declaration, and that creates the primary constructor. And then those primary constructor parameters that you add are in scope throughout the rest of the class or struct definition. Mm-hmm. So you can obviously already do this on record types, but they're making this available in structs and classes.
Very nice.
Which is cool. And so the primary constructor will be, so if you then go ahead and add some other constructors to your class or struct, you've always got to come back through that primary constructor. So they're always required.
Right.
And you call back into that primary constructor with this. So that's cool. It's just adding some belt and braces to your classes or structs. Cool. If you need to create them in a valid state, for example, that requires some specific parameters, you might look at using a primary constructor. So that's cool. Yeah. What else have we got? We've also got collection expressions. So this is an easy way to initialize a collection. So whether that be an array or even a span or a list, I think there's list support. I think actually from reading the documentation, I think it may apply to a number of different IEnumerables, which is quite nice.
Right.
And so previously in earlier versions of C#, each of the different collections has got its own sort of initializer syntax, doesn't it? So, with a list, you'd say, give me a new list, and you can use the curly braces and enter your items and arrays similar. Mm-hmm. But they're moving to what they're calling collection expressions, where you can simply just specify sort of square brackets, similar to what you can do in TypeScript, for example.
Right. Nice.
And you can specify an array with, by opening a square bracket and putting in your array elements and closing square brackets. So, and you can do similar things with lists and different collection types as well. So it's removes a lot of the verbosity from,
doesn't it? Yeah.
Creating.
Yeah. Looking at the example we've got there for that, it does take away quite a lot of the verbosity of it. So yeah, nice.
Exactly. And the way you tell the compiler what type you're initializing is, instead of a var keyword. So if you've got, variable X, instead of saying var X, you'd say int, and then your array declaration or a list or a span or a
Absolutely. It does seem like with this and the obviously the new keyword not needing if you had I'd say it, but yeah, basically they seem to be reducing the language again. You're taking away all the bits you don't need, because obviously they had it duplicated on both sides, and then they put var, so you only need it on one side.
Yeah.
And then they've now, if you put it on one side, you could just use the new keyword, and
slowly
getting less and less and less, which is great, because it's just all work. It's just extra stuff to look at and deal with. So the more they take away, the better, really.
The better, And I think a lot of this is because the compiler is becoming more and more sophisticated can infer types, And just a final point on this, there's also support for the spread operator. So again, similar to TypeScript in that if you've already got a collection of elements and you'd like to sort of spread that collection into another collection, you can use the spread operator, which is basically three dots, followed by the variable. So that's cool.
It's quite a nice way of doing it,
like excellent. What else have we got? Inline arrays. So this is more of an internal feature, but it's a slightly different way of specifying a fixed, a fixed size array, and that comes, you sort of use that with a built-in inline array attribute. But that's going to be a feature that's more used by the framework developers themselves, or sort of internal stuff, but worthwhile being aware of.
Yeah, interesting. Okay,
nice. Cool. Other things are things like optional parameters in Lambda expressions. So up until this point, you've had to specify all of your parameters in your Lambda expressions, and they can't have optional values, basically, whereas now they can, which is quite cool. We moving on, we can have ref read only parameters. So previously there were restrictions around your in and ref parameters. Now you can make them, now you can make a ref parameter read only, making sure that they don't get modified.
Cool.
Moving on, we can now alias any type in C#. So our using statements at the top of the file, you can alias things, not just other classes in namespaces, but you can alias things, like tuples or array types or pointer types or any other unsafe types. So that's quite useful.
Yeah. Okay.
Cool. C# 12 has got a new thing called an experimental attribute. So if you are releasing some functionality that is experimental or, not quite there yet, you can adorn it with the experimental attribute. Right. And there are some compiler warnings that are sort of built in against the experimental attribute if you leave that in, which is quite cool.
I think I'll just put that on all my code, to be honest.
It's all experimental.
Warn people. Yeah.
Yeah, very cool. Moving on. There's a new thing called interceptors, which it looks like have been introduced really to support AOT, ahead of time compilation. But what is an interceptor? Andy, you
thanks a lot for that. So I had to sort of look into it. It's a weird one, this one. So basically it substitutes a call. So it's a difficult, there's some good, Andrew Locke has got a good page on this actually. So if you follow him on, you want to look at his blog, he's got a very good example of it. It's sort of a made up example, but it does show you it. So basically it's weird. You've obviously got your code as normal, but what you do is you write an interceptor, which is sort of a separate chunk of code, but it actually references your file and the line of code that you want to actually do the interception on. So it's got to have the correct lines and everything. And then basically what it will now do is see that you've got this interceptor, and at compile time, it will strip out your version and replace it with the one that you've told it to, the interceptor.
Brilliant. Yeah. Okay.
And it just happens at compile time. You don't need to do it. Having a good use case for it, good question. I haven't thought of any yet, but obviously it's in there for a good reason. And I guess they're using it behind the scenes to do replacing of certain things. A bit like you said, the maps and the gets and all that sort of thing could well be replaced with stuff like this. I don't know. They might have a boilerplate that goes in and does it. The thing that gets me about this is you have to be quite specific about where you're going to replace things. So that's quite interesting how people do that. Because, of course, if your code changes slightly, you've got to go back and make those changes as well. So, I don't quite know how that's going to work, but... it's there and it's going to be useful for some people. So
I think, as you say, I think that the primary use case is probably for AOT support, so they can replace you know, lower level methods with, yes, with, you know, with native platform specific methods. Yeah.
But it, I mean, it is interesting that these things, of course, because they're putting them into the language for what they need to use and what they do, it's obviously becoming available for us to use as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's bringing some powerful things in and allowing us to use them. So, you know, careful with it all, really.
Exactly. With great power. Yeah,
that's
exactly
what I was trying to think of. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, marvelous.
In the foot with that one.
Definitely. Excellent. Well, I think that covers off the C# 12 stuff.
Yep.
Again, not an exhaustive list, but some of the interesting stuff that we thought was worth a mention.
Sure.
Let's now come on to the fundamental .NET 8 stuff. So we've covered ASP.NET, as in the, you know, the web stuff. We've covered C# 12 that comes out with .NET 8. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to some of the improvements and some of the new stuff in the, you know, in foundational .NET. You know, base. What have we got?
Yeah, so the first one, big one, is system.txt.json, which was obviously introduced. You know, most people use NewtonSoft. But obviously this system.txt.json was introduced, and it's got, you know, had a lot of features already. Wasn't quite there. It does things in different ways. That's how it wasn't quite there. It does.
Blazingly fast from day one, wasn't it? That was one of the one of the key sort of goals, and and they, you know, they've done well with that. But but I think what they achieved in performance, they probably sort of trimmed down feature-wise, didn't they?
Yeah, I think they had to, really, just to get it out there and get it being used. That they had to do that. But it's, you know, now they're improving it. They're starting to bring new features into it. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff coming in with .NET 8. You've got now required and init member support.
Init, nice.
init. disabling reflection defaults.
Yeah.
Size reduction. Populating read-only members,
nice.
Missing member handling, new JSON naming policies, so you can now do things like snake case,
very cool,
and underscore,
and kebab case, with
a hyphen.
Very cool.
So there's all that sort of thing, which is, you know, people need it because different systems do these things different ways. So interface hierarchy support, built-in support for half int 128 and a uint 128.
Cool. Yeah, some of those lesser used data types, but I mean, if you need them, you need them, don't you? So
absolutely, that's it. Yeah, yeah. You don't
ruin realize. Your day if you you know, if there's no support for it.
And then built-in support for memory T and read-only memory T.
Yeah.
So, you know, useful if you need it again, and you know, people are going to be using some of these things. Single usage. This was a funny one. We spoke about this just before we started doing the recording, but single usage JSON serializer options. And it's something I hadn't even realized. It's one of these performance things where if you know, this is where the, you know, micro optimizations, but you know, once you want to start analyzing your code and optimizing it, these are the sort of things that can come up and actually catch you. So this is the idea that when you create JSON serializer options, it's not that expensive to create them, but metadata caches are recalculated or calculated on every serialization. So if you keep creating these serializer options, you basically get the cost of that every single time. So if you can create singletons of the JSON serializer options and reuse them, you've obviously saved all that time. So it's a performance thing. But the nice thing is they've also introduced this analyzer, CA1869, which is basically going to give you a warning if it detects single-use options. So they're trying to protect you from making, you know, trying to push you down the right route of, you know, it's not an error. It's not going to go wrong, but, you know, you could get a bit of an improvement if you do this.
So, right. Yeah. So when we're using the JSON serializer, the serialize method, for example, will take a JSON serializer options instance.
Yep.
And I guess the thing that most people will be doing is if you're calling that serialize method, and you're serializing with specific options, i.e. not the default options, you new up a new JSON serializer options each time you call serialize.
That's right.
And
so
they are saying that if you're newing up a new JSON serializer options for every serialize call you're making, you're potentially taking on an extra hit around the metadata that gets generated for each of those options instances. So they've introduced this analyzer to just point out the fact that you're newing up JSON serializer options over and over and over, and you could therefore be, you know, wasting CPU cycles. Whereas I think the recommendation now is to say, okay, make a JSON serializer options once, i.e. singleton, and reuse that over and over and over if you're calling serialized multiple times.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Because normally, the way the stuff you pass into the serializer options doesn't change. It's normally you set it up to be what you want it to be. So, you know, example, we look at a lot, right, indented, so it looks like you want to see it. Yeah. Or
your casing options. Casing, or that's
And generally that stays the same throughout your application. So, yeah, create it once, reuse it everywhere. So
Quite
a nice little one to get used to.
Nice.
And then extending the JSON include attribute and the JSON constructor attribute to support non-public members.
Brilliant. So excellent.
Yeah, loads. And again, that's not an exhaustive list. There's all sorts. There's a link to the article on Microsoft about it, but there's loads more. You know, they're really improving it, so it's just going to get better and better. So
good stuff. Yeah. I mean, it was blazingly fast from day one, and it's great to see that they're now pushing the sort of the breadth of the feature support and still improving performance as well. It's pretty impressive what they've done with that. Yeah,
that's great. It's really good for us. Yeah, it just gets better and better. So
absolutely.
Yeah. Right.
Cool. What do we got next?
So moving on. So the next thing, a big one again, keyed DI services. So this was, I mean, years and years ago, we were using this sort of thing in other dependency injection and frameworks. And I think they've probably been asked for this for so long, and I don't know why they pushed back on it. Whether it was a technology thing or just didn't fit into what they already had. But yeah, this is now there. Do you want to talk about this?
Yeah, well, basically, we can now in the dependency injection container, we can now associate a key with instances of stuff. So, where previously, if you had two implementations of a particular interface, there was no way to tell the difference between those implementations. There were certain tricks that you could use by registering a delegate and then making that delegate sort of accept a key, and then you'd write essentially a switch statement, and then you could return your particular instance. But that's a bit of a sort of a workaround. Yeah. They've now introduced specific keying capabilities against particular instances. So, so you can, if you're we've got an example here that we're looking at where you might have an iMemory cache and you might have two different implementations of that memory cache. So you might have a big cache and a small cache. You can now register them with a key. So you can say, you build a dot services dot, and there's a new method called add keyed singleton, or I'd imagine there's an add keyed, transient and add keyed. All of them, HTTP request version. And you simply pass in your key that you want to register it with. So yeah, useful. And it's something that lots of, that I think we've been missing ever since we all moved over to the ASP.
Absolutely.
The .NET dependency injection container. Something that was available in a lot of the older.
Yeah, I was going to say, because of course, before they never really offered a DI or a container sort of thing. You always used third-party ones. And I remember using things like Ninject.
AutoFac.
There were loads of them. I think most of them offered this sort of thing. When you came into this, they didn't really offer it. The only thing you had is that, if you registered things multiple times, that was fine if you had an enumerable instance of it and you wanted that. But otherwise, there was no way of registering the same thing. It was always the last one you registered.
Last one wins. There you go.
And you had to work around it. But very nice, very nice. It's going to make life a bit simpler. So
absolutely. Brilliant. Excellent.
Moving on.
Next one.
Lifecycle services.
Yeah, cool. So we've got some extra extension points on an iHosted service now, don't we? So up until this point, you've been able to hook into the start and stop methods, events with the start async and stop async implementations. Now we've got a few more extension points. So we've got starting async and started as well as the start. So, just before you call start, you've got starting, then you've got start, and then you've got started once you started. So a few more extension points. Same thing with stop, with stopping, stop and stopped, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. It's not groundbreaking, but it's just nice. You've now got that ability to trigger things just before or just after, or do tidy up or whatever you need to do. Do you know, I see a lot more of these hosted services out there now, because they're so easy to actually build and use, and they're great because you can just trigger stuff to keep going in the background. So I'm seeing more of these things being used out there, so it's nice to have these extra little points to get into. But excellent. Moving on, so we've got sort of gone through most of it now, haven't we? And we've sort of covered all the bits we wanted to cover, and really it's just a summary of all the various bits now. So again, we rattle through a few of these. There's so much to look at, and it's going to be interesting using .NET 8 and sort of seeing all these, how you can use them, and and actually sort of keeping track of it all. There's
definitely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the core .NET libraries, there's a whole host of improvements, you know, across a load of those different libraries. So, you know, there's serialization improvements, you know, there's time abstraction, there's UTF-8 improvements, methods for working with randomness, performance focus types, system numerics and runtime, intrinsics, data validation, metrics, cryptography, networking, stream-based zip file methods. Nice. Just to name a few. So as with all of these major .NET releases, the whole thing gets all the teams, all the .NET teams will have worked on this. So
yeah,
there's a whole host of improvements.
I guess as well. So when you say the whole .NET team, of course that includes everybody in the world really, because it's all open source.
Yeah.
There's probably a lot of this stuff that's come from.
It's coming from people. Yeah, open source pull requests. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Really
absolutely.
Nice to see.
So. Yep. Yeah, so I mean, as well as those core .NET libraries, there's extension library updates, you know, things like option validation, logger message attribute, extension metrics, hosted lifecycle services, we've already covered that, you know, TDI services, we covered that, system numerics, tensors and tensor primitives. So some of the darker sort of corners that many people probably don't venture into have had a bit of an update. You know, those are some of the libraries, but you know, things like garbage collection and configuration binding, source generator, reflection improvements, and a lot of AOT support, you know, native AOT support. We've already covered that. That, of course, there's going to be performance improvements. The .NET SDK, there's updates, you know, to the development sort of kit side of things, globalization, container updates, you know, there's image updates. As with all .NET, you know, major revisions, source code generated, com interop, .NET on Linux has been improved, cross build window apps. Yeah, cool. AOT compilation for Android apps, of course, code analysis, WPF, that's something we haven't touched for a long while, but that's, you know, that's still going strong. And NuGet and diagnostics, like the list goes on and on and on. There's, you know, it's way too much to cover in an audio program like this, really. And really the advice is, I mean, if you didn't get it already, is to go off and really deep dive into the areas that you're really
interested in. I mean, the Microsoft site's so good for all this stuff. A lot of this that we pulled together has come from their sites. They do lots of, you know, what we've just released, you know, and you just get sort of release one, release two, release three, release four, then you get an RC candidate, and then you get more releases, and then you get another RC candidate. So they sort of, you know, give you all the details of what they're putting in there and everything else. It's a huge amount of it. So
absolutely,
yeah, it's great. It's really good to look at. But I mean, what we're hoping to do is we want to try and take some of these and actually do some YouTube short videos about them, just because obviously you just can't get some of this. Even, you know, the very first ones we talked about, where you've got like the debugger improvements, it'd be nice to just see those in a quick video so you can see it visually. So what we're going to try and start doing, some of these YouTube shorts about the .NET 8 features, and maybe as we use them, we'll try and do them and sort of highlight things that are becoming useful. You know, I guess the keyed DI services and various bits like that, and
absolutely, even something as simple as the object initializers in C#12. The collection initializers. It's so much easier sort of seeing an example. It's quite difficult for us to explain code.
It is in an audio
program, isn't it? But
no, absolutely. But we're trying to do that. So we've got the YouTube channel set up. So we've got .NET Rambles YouTube channel, and we'll start putting stuff in it. There's not a lot there at the moment because it's only created few days ago, but we'll start chucking stuff up there as soon as we can, and we'll obviously link to it from the website and link to it from these podcasts. But it'd be really good, and hopefully we'll get some feedback from them and be able to get some views on them and see what people think of them.
Marvelous. Really looking forward to it. Good stuff.
Excellent.
What open source project or utility of the week have we got this week?
Well, it's funny. I had to go back and double check this. So I came up with this one, and I went back through all the previous episodes just to double check. So I would have thought we definitely sort of reviewed this one already, because I use it every day. I don't know about you. It's my go-to. It's just literally open most of the time. It's Notepad++.
Of course. Who doesn't? Absolutely.
It just sits, you know, I think throughout my career, I've gone through so many Notepad things. And I use a thing called Notepad 2 as well, which is some of Flow's freeware, I think that comes from. So it's a Notepad replacement, which is a nice quick one. But, you know, Notepad++, it's got, you know, tabs. It's got all sorts of features. It's just so useful.
It's really useful. I mean, there are so many useful features. One of the things that has saved me time and time again is just the fact that it sort of saves each of the tabs that you've got open. Yeah. So if you close it down or your machine dies or whatever, you reboot your machine, you start up Notepad++ again, and all your tabs are still there. That is great. I've lost count of the number of times that saved me.
Yeah, yeah. I've unfortunately lost count of the number of tabs I've got open.
So have I.
Because you just keep, you open a new tab, paste it in, and unfortunately, yeah, because it saves it for you, you just leave it there. So I've got so many called, you know, tab 1, tab 2, 3, yeah, 34, yeah, 58.
Yeah. Unsaved stuff. And yeah, every now and then I'll go through and sort of clear it out. But it's a bit nerve-wracking thing. Yeah, do I need this?
I'll just leave it there for now. Yeah,
exactly.
I want to group them together really and just chuck them out of the way for a bit. But yeah, maybe that's a feature we can put in it.
That'd be a nice feature, wouldn't it? Well, it does have plugin support, doesn't it? So perhaps we could write a plugin to do that. Yeah,
absolutely. There probably is one, actually. Yeah, somebody will tell us. But yeah, no doubt there is one. But yeah, fantastic. Yeah, so that brings us to the end of that. So, good episode. It's interesting to go through all those and see what's coming, what's going to be available by the time this goes out. So
yeah,
you know, all of these things will be out there being used. So
absolutely, and hopefully we'll be jumping onto .NET 8 as soon as we can. Yeah, looking forward to it.
Absolutely. Yeah, maybe a follow-up one where we sort of can sort of say what's been good and what's not been so good, or what's been really useful, but who knows. But yeah, it's interesting times with it all. It's lots of good stuff happening, so
definitely exciting times for sure. Andy, it's been great to catch up. It's been too long. Let's not leave it so long next time. Well, absolutely, we're not going to leave it so long next time.
Definitely,
we will we'll catch up again next week. Who knows what we're going to talk about? We've got a long list of stuff that we could possibly cover.
Absolutely. We've left it a while, so there's a lot of things built up, so lots and lots of things to talk about. So we'll get them ready.
Have a good chat
next week.
So. Leave it as a surprise.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, mate. Till next week.
Yeah. Thanks very much for that.
You too.
Speak soon. Cheers.
Bye.